1996, vers minuit, un Boeing 757 d'Aéroupérou décolle de Lima. Dans l'après-midi, les mécaniciens ont lavé l'avion. Et pour éviter que de l'eau ne pénètre dans les capteurs extérieurs de vitesse et d'altitude, ils les ont recouverts d'adhésifs. Malheureusement, ils ont oublié d'enlever ces bouchons improvisés. Du coup, les instruments de bord donnent des indications erronées. En théorie, c'est une situation gérable.
Just to explain, so this is the Aéroupérou accident, very famous one. What happened exactly is that the flight mechanics had to wash the aircraft, okay, and they put some rubber or some things on the pitot tube, okay, on the sensor that helped to get the, this pitot tube was very useful for getting your altitude, your vertical speed, and your altitude. But the mechanics has forgotten to remove the rubber on the pitot tube. So the two pilots are going to perform the takeoff with no vertical speed, no altitude, and no speed. And what the journalist said is that pilots are trained to face such situations. It's not that critical, okay?
Pour la suite, retournons à notre pièce de théâtre du début, dont je vous rappelle que le texte est très exactement celui de la transcription d'une boîte noire.
Tonight, we would like to address these issues. Like, we would like to understand what happened in the pilot's brain, what that led them to what we call mental cognitivity, flexibility impairments. They are unable to perform any decision making. They have face some attentional tuning issues, and they fail to perceive relevant information like relevant auditory alarm. Of course, there are lots of stress, a lot of emotion in this situation. So, what is interesting, if we may say interesting, in this movie is that there are no communication between the two crew members. They all face something like we call attentional tuning. They are only focused on one task. They don't communicate that much, and they persist on erroneous. They only focus on erroneous information. Okay, they only focus on erroneous attitude. They have to get rid with the attitude. They have to get rid about the error speed. They have some beacon that are still operative in the cockpit, like the attitude indicator still working, but they don't take into account the attitude indicator. They can use the position of the levers. There are other information available in the cockpit, but they don't seem to be able to process this kind of information. And at the very end of the movie, they have this pull-up auditory alarm, and they don't take into account this pull-up auditory alarm, okay? Because it's such a mess in the cockpit that their brain are not able anymore to process this kind of information. Just to present very shortly my lab. So I'm leading a lab, like a 12 people lab, here in Supero, and our approach is called neuroergonomics. So for neuroscience, of course, ergonomics for human factors. It's applied to aviation safety. And we do study using fMRI to understand decision-making issues, attentional issues. And then we go to more ecological platforms like micro-world, motion flight simulator, and then we also conduct experiments in real flight conditions. Okay, so the idea is to go from lab to everyday activity. And in the lab, it's a multidisciplinary lab involving people with a background in neuroscience, human factor, signal processing, and computer science. It's very important to merge all this expertise in one lab if you want to do such research. Just to explain why are we so interested in neuroscience, and what can one neuroscience can tell us about neurons? I've been conducted some like 12, 14 years ago such experiments using flight sim. And in this experiment, the pilots were supposed to fly from waypoint 1, waypoint 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, and then perform an ILS landing. The thing is that they didn't have enough fuel to achieve the mission. So we placed some tankers in the sky, and they just had to hit the tankers to get some additional fuel, okay? And so the tankers were here and here. What happened with one pilot was quite interesting, because he started to take off from weapon 1 to reach these weapons, and then instead of going to weapon 6 for refueling, he decided, we don't know why, to divert to weapon 5. And then he started losing fuel, didn't have enough fuel, so he started circling around, trying desperately to reach weapon 5. So at the end, he crashed, I mean, in the flight simulator, so that was not that dramatic. But we had the occasion to talk with his pilot, because he was alive, and he told us that he thought that the tanker was on weapon 5. Okay, so he went on weapon 5 for once. He said, I didn't see the tanker, maybe I missed it. So he started to suck him for another round. No, I didn't see it. And then he started another time, and then they crashed. And what was interesting in this situation is that he had all the available information in front of his eyes. He had all this, the position of the aircraft, he had the tactical map just in the cockpit. But he was unable to process this information. He was only trusting, I mean, his representation is mine. Similar things occur here, but the pilot was unable to adapt to the situation. So they face what we call perseveration. And in the situation, as I told you, all the data were available in the user interface. If we go back to the human factors literature, there are something called fixation errors, and there are three types. The very first one is the human operator is unable to make up their mind to achieve a goal. For example, you have I don't know if you have any experience of flying, especially light aircraft, but if you have a failure, you have to make up your mind to find a ground to land. Okay, I don't know exactly the term in English, but in French we say vacher. We have immediately to perform an emergency landing. And in these situations, it happened once in Supero, one of our pilots, he was unable to make up his mind because his landing ground appeared to be too short. The other one was rocky. the other one, there was a cliff, so he was unable to make up his mind. Eventually, he survived, but he said that for like 2 or 3 minutes, he was unable to find a solution. Type 2, the human operator keeps on doing the same action without any kind of control. So, doing some experiments with pilots, we observe them programming the FMS, the flight management system, and they keep on doing the same error. They're unable to adapt to the situation. They keep, due to fatigue, to stress, they keep doing the same things. It seems that they have no control, no motor control. And then, what we observed in the previous experiments is that the, sometimes, I will show you a lot of movie today, tonight, sorry, the human operator, I mean the pilot, has overconfidence in their strategy, and they neglect or they do not trust any external cues like the auditory alarms. So in one case, they may perceive the auditory alarm, but they say, no, it's a false alarm. So this is what we call the prime wolf effect. And in other cases, I will show you a video in a minute, they really don't perceive, they don't pay attention to the auditory alarm. So that's very, very interesting in terms of neural process. And what are the explanation? The explanation are how close situation, stress, fatigue. Stress, fatigue may lead to this kind of situations, like the one we've observed in the movie. When I was talking, I had a cooperation with INSERM, which is a French medical institute, and these people work with brain injured people, like people facing Parkinson's disease. And I was talking to Joël Pasteur, one of my colleagues at INSERM, and I was telling her about this kind of human error that occurs in the cockpit. And she said, it's amazing, but we observe exactly the same kind of behavior with our patients. Okay, I'm not saying that pilots are brain injured people. I'm not saying that, please. Just saying that people, I mean healthy people, but stress, or facing stressing situation under fatigue, may have similar behavior than people with brain injuries. And so she conducted an experiment like 10 years ago, and people have to perform the decision task that requires attentional processes and so on. So she has Parkinson people with prefrontal lesion, Parkinson people performing the task. And these people were unable to adapt to the quick evolution of the micro world of the task. And then she put healthy people like you and I, but she stressed them with fatigue or with caffeine. If you drink a lot of caffeine, you feel really stressed, okay? So she managed to stress healthy people, and these healthy people make exactly the same errors as the brain injured people. And interestingly enough, if you take a look at what we call this executive syndrome, the first one is abulia. So abulia is incapacity for decision making. If you ask these people, just choose between a shirt or a t-shirt, for example, a very simple choice, they're unable to do the simple choice. You also observe perseveration and psychomotor response. If you ask these people to draw a circle, they will draw a circle. But if you ask them to draw a rectangle, for example, or a square, they would be unable to shift from the circle task to the square task. Okay? They keep on drawing circles. And in the last one, there is a very famous test called Wisconsin card, a sorting card test. And you have to find, it's a game of cards, and you have to find the rule. And these people are very good to find the first rule. But then when you change the rule, these people are unable to adapt to the new rules. But if you remember fixation error, type 1, type 2, type 3, it's exactly, from an observable point of view, it's exactly the same kind of behavioral performance. And this is why we are really interested in neuroscience, because we can learn a lot from neuroscience, neuropsychology, and brain injuries to better understand pilot performance. So that was just the introduction. We're going to talk about emotion, stress, and decision making. If you look at the stats, so when you want to fly, you have to taxi, climb, cruise, descend, and then there's what we call the final approach and the landing. this is a very short flight phase. I mean, we only spend 16% of the time landing. But if you take a look at here, I don't know if you see really, it concentrates 51% of human error. So, I mean, sorry, 51% of crashes. So 51% of crashes occurs during landing. But landing is a very short flight phase. And if you take a look at air safety reports, you observe a lot of what we call perseveration. Pilot have persisted in erroneous decision making, landing decision making. Of course, I mean, it's quite strange because landing is a highly rational task. You have to supervise parameters, you need to have the correct speed, you have the correct altitude, you have the correct vertical speed. So it's purely rational. If you don't have the correct parameters, you have to perform the go around. But of course, pilots have also a lot of emotional bias. So everybody knows, is aware that performing a go around, costs a lot of money. Okay, it costs a lot of money for the airline to perform a go around. So the pilots really do not want to perform a go around. Because also the passenger will not be really happy. Because when you want to land in London, you want to land in London, not in, I mean, in Ireland or in Scotland, especially today. And it's of course an aversive situation because at the end you have to land. So it's best to land on the final destination. There's a lot of uncertainty and complexity. And for pilots, it's still difficult to perform a ground. It means I'm not a good pilot. Manage to land successfully. So all this pressure may affect decision making. And there are a lot of research conducted, it started like 10, 15 years ago, called neuroeconomics, in order to understand how emotion can bias decision making. Just a short slide to show you that there's kind of simple hypothesis called the cognition emotion shift hypothesis. So, no matter the name of the brain area, but when you perform a task, for example that one, you have to say, you have 2 to 2, in fact you have to say 3. You don't have to say 2, you have to say 3. Okay, it's called a strict test, it's one condition. And when you perform this task, you will activate this part of the brain. Okay? And then if you perform a similar task but with emotional cues, like murderer, or rape, things like this, it induces emotional emotional situation, then you will activate this part of the brain. Okay, so it's not the same when you perform a cognitive task, a rational one, or emotional one. But the interesting thing is that when you perform the cognitive task, the rational one, you inhibit the emotional part of the brain. Okay, so when you do this task, the rational one, and you inhibit, you reset, in a sense, the emotional part of the brain. And on the contrary, when you perform the emotional task, you activate this part of the brain, but in return, you inhibit the rational part of the brain. So there is a kind of shift, okay, between emotional, when you're performing emotional task or pure rational task. And you can observe here, when you have a cool rational decision making, you may activate this part of the brain, and you inhibit this part of the brain in order not to be disturbed by emotional biases. And our idea is that pilots may be biased in this way when they have to land due to their previous emotional bias. The idea was to reproduce a landing decision task, and we use fMRI. So fMRI, I don't know if you're familiar, but you can scan the brain activity, and you place people in this kind of devices. So very, very impressive. But when pilots have to perform their landing decision task, they supervise the, what we call the primary flight display. They supervise the speed, the position of these promoters, and etc. It's an expertise. And if they don't want to perform the go-around, most of the time, they hit the levers to perform a go-around. So you just have to push the levers, I mean, with the nerves, and then automatically you perform a go-around. So it's what we call a go-no-go task, go or no-go. So we place pilots in fMRI, and they simplify primary flight display, and they have to decide whether or not to land, depending on the information. And the funny thing is, in one condition, it was pure rational task. They only have to analyze the displays, the earnest, the situation, and then make up their mind. And in another condition, there was also an incentive condition. So they say, if you perform the landing, then you will earn €5. If you perform a go round, you will lose €2. So you will lose systematically €2, because even if it's a good decision, performing a go round is adversely situated, because you lose time, you lose money, etc. And if they perform an erroneous going around decision, they lose €5. So each trial, they are able to lose or to earn money. So this was performed with INSERM and Fondazione Santa Lucia in Roma. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but of course, in the money conditions, I mean the rational condition, it was like safety first, pilots correctly were a good decision maker. When we induced the incentive condition with the money, pilots were more likely to land, of course, because they want to earn money, they want to earn €5, and so we observe poor decision making. And we also observe this bias between the emotional part of the brain in the incentive condition versus the rational part of the brain which was activated in the rational conditions. And I don't want to bother you with stats and anything, but here we have some errors that are known to be highly involved in rational tasks. Okay, and if you take a look at this, each dot is a pilot. So this pilot is a very risky pilot, and the one on this part are good decision maker. This one is a very safe pilot. And what the graph means is that this pilot, who is a very good decision maker, he has high cognitive activity in this part of the brain, in the rational part of the brain. And on the opposite, this pilot, who is a poor decision maker, a risky pilot, he has very low activation of the rational part of the brain. So you can see this kind of balance. And interestingly enough, we observe this kind of same phenomenon with visual errors. Okay, so in the incentive condition with the money, people were so likely to, they wanted so badly to earn the money that they didn't care about the stimulus in the environment, and they, in a way, some way, deactivate their visual areas. They were not that much processing visual information. Another important topic in the human factors, especially in aeronautics, mental workload. And the thing is, with mental workload, most of people, human factors, say that, of course, when the task is more demanding, then you will recruit more brain activation. So you will activate more deeply your brain areas. And then, as the task begins to be more difficult, then the brain activation will increase, especially in the prefrontal parts of the brain. And then you reach a plateau. And our hypothesis, based on neuroscientific evidence, that was your brain, of course, start to respond correctly to the task demand, and then when the task demand is excessive, then you decrease your brain activation. So you don't have a plateau, you have a kind of activation, and then you decrease, you kind of inhibition of your brain. And this is supported by a lot of work conducted in your neuroscientific community. For example, if you ask people to perform a task in a day, they perform it very well. If the task is more demanding, then the brain will respond in consequence. But then you wake up these poor participants in the middle of the night, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the night, wake them up and you ask them to perform the task. And these people are unable to perform the task, and interestingly enough, that you measure that the prefrontal part of the brain is totally inhibited, okay, due to fatigue, they're unable to face the task. Similar tasks were performed where you place people also in fMRI. Okay, they have to do very simple tasks, very very simple tasks. And then, so this is one condition. In another condition, you say to these people that if they fail, if they don't succeed in the task, then you will hit them with a pin. It's going to be more and more painful. Of course, you don't hurt people, but as they are stuck in the fMRI, stress, very facing highly stressed because they are fear about being hit by the pin, they're unable to perform the task. Okay, in fact, you just hit the fingers, but they are so stressed that they think you have hit them with the pin. And these people are not able anymore to perform very, very simple tasks. And interestingly enough, you also observe deactivation, LAMA activation of the prefrontal part of the brain. So this seems to support this idea of optimum and then a deactivation. So to do this kind of experiments, fMRI is a fantastic device, but the thing is that you can't place fMRI in your cockpit. You can use it in a flight simulator. So you need more portable device. And there's a kind of brand new device called functional near infrared spectroscopy. Let me show you the picture here. And you can place it on the forehead. And I mean, it's quite similar to the fMRI because you emit infrared through the scalp. And then when there is an underlying neural activity, your brain will consume oxygen. Okay, and oxygen will absorb infrared. So depending on what you emit and what the receiver, the light detector receive, you will able to process brain activation. To infer brain activation. So and you can measure different points of the prefrontal cortex. And the thing is interesting because it gives more or less similar evidence to fMRI studies. Some of our colleagues have used this kind of device to measure, to use this kind of device in flight simulator. So you can see that depending on the task, you may measure specific activation of the brain. So in order to test our hypothesis, we develop a very simple task, and the participant was supposed to operate this plane to follow one of these, following the cue. So this is green and yellow. You don't have to follow the green plane, you have to follow the yellow plane. Okay? So the pilot will have to follow that one. And we increase the difficulty using different conditions. I don't want to bother you with that, but we have four levels of difficulty. And the highest level of difficulty, it was impossible, nearly about impossible to perform the task. So the participants were facing high workload. And they also had alarms. They had to hit different alarms and so on. So according to our hypothesis, we found some, so this is the task when it's easy, when it's become, so the task is more getting more difficult. Here it's becoming to be very difficult, and right here, the task is nearly impossible to perform. And you observe this kind of invert U shape that is consistent with the hypothesis that when you face an excessive workload, you're unable to cope with the situation. I don't know if you've already flown an aircraft, but in some very stressing situation, doing some simple calculations, sometimes very hard, to calculate bearing or anything, or fuel consumption, could be very difficult in a very highly stressing situation. Maybe this kind of result plus the other one tend to show that you have some kind of inhibition of this part of the brain. Another really interesting issue is what we call inattentional deafness. But before telling you about inattentional deafness, I'd like to perform a task with you. So we'll do some. I guess most of you know this task, but anyway. Sorry for that.
the monkey business origin. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the ball. The correct answer is 16 passes. Did you spot the gorilla?
So how many of you spot the gorillas?
Wow. Seen it before.
So some... and did you spot, sorry, did you spot other changes in the scene?
I haven't seen or heard about a video like this before. About half missed the gorilla. If you knew about the gorilla, you probably saw it. But did you notice the curtain changing color for the player on the black team leaving the game? Let's rewind and watch it again. Here comes the gorilla, and there goes a player, and the curtain is changing from red to gold. When you're looking for a gorilla, you often miss other unexpected events.
Yeah, I got another interesting movies.
Hi, I'm Richard. This is Sarah, and we're going to perform the amazing color-changing card trick with this blue-backed deck of cards. Now, the idea is very simple. I'm just going to spread the cards in front of Sarah and ask her to push any card towards the camera.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to go for this card here.
Okay. Now, Sarah could have selected any card at all from the deck, but she selected the card which is now face down on the table. What I'm going to ask her to do is show us which card she selected.
Right, so the card that I chose was, in fact,
the three of diamonds. Okay, excellent choice. That card goes back into the deck. Now I'm just going to spread the cards face up on the table. Give a little click of the fingers, and you'll see that Sarah's card here has now got a blue back. Not particularly surprising. What's slightly more surprising is all of the other cards have got red backs. And that is the amazing color changing. Hi, I'm Richard, this is Sarah, and we're going to perform the amazing color-changing card trick with this blue-backed deck of cards. Now, the idea is very simple. I'm just going to spread the cards in front of Sarah and ask her to push any card towards the camera.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to go for this card here.
Okay. Now, Sarah could have selected any card at all from the deck, but she selected the card which is now face down on the table. What I'm going to ask her to do is show us which card she selected.
Right, so the card that I chose was, in fact, the three of diamonds.
The three of diamonds are an excellent choice. That card goes back into the deck. Now I'm just going to spread the cards face up on the table. Give a little click of the fingers, and you'll see that Sarah's card here has now got a blue back. Not particularly surprising. What's slightly more surprising is all of the other cards have got red backs. And that is the amazing color changing card trick.
Okay, so I guess probably so all the changes in the scene. Okay, you're very good. What we learned from that is that attentional process, I mean, the way we focus on things are. I mean, depend on how you sorry for that. So I depend on top level goals. I mean, when you want to land, you have to. You take a look at you glance at the landing ground. Landing gear indicator. You look at the vertical speed, but I mean, you don't look at all the information. You don't take into account all the information. Okay, depending on your goal, you select information. And for the first one with the goal reductions, we are told to count the path, the white path, so you count the white path, and this is why you don't perceive the gorillas, okay? Because it's not relevant for your task, okay? Just another video to show aperture limitations. Anyway, it's a flicker, and in fact there are two pictures, and I mean this is basically the same picture, but there are two differences between the, there's one difference between the, so this is a flicker, in fact there are two different, I mean the image is the same, there's one difference between the two images. Did you spot the difference?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the engine. But probably if that didn't tell you that there were any difference between the two images, you would have never spot such a difference. So let's get back to the cockpits. Do you see scary movies? This is a real flight. It's a Telegram TB20 flight, and the pilots have to land here at Megève Airport. It's in the mountain, so it's a really tricky landing, high difficult landing. And there are two expert pilots in the cockpit, and the backseater is a cameraman. So you see, you have to perform. So now they have. Sorry for the sound. They have an auditory alarm that starts yelling. So, any ideas about the meaning of the alarm?
Yes.
Not a stall.
Landing gear.
Yeah, landing gear. And sorry, the sound is very noisy, but you can't, it's really audible, I mean, within the headset. So. And they didn't seem to react to this auditory alarm. So the alarm will land, will yell for one minute. Okay. So hopefully they survive the crash. And they said, no, we didn't have any auditory alarm. So this is when they saw the movie, when they saw the camera, I mean the movie from the camera, that they said, okay, there was an auditory alarm. But they said that we didn't notice the alarm. And one of my colleagues working at, one of my friends working at Air France showed me a really impressive movie. So it's you have to just have to look this picture, this movie on the left, on the right corner. So this is training in a Boeing, maybe I don't know the kind of airplane, but anyway. And it's a training situation. And they have to perform a go around. So just here to illustrate the positions of the levers, the sticks, the primary flight display. Anyway, and you see here the trajectory. And in fact, they made an error in the programming of the flight management system. And they're going to turn left onto the mountain.
Thank you.
touch back there on. They didn't perceive the auto trail on. Okay, they were so focused on reprogramming the FMS or trying to understand the situation because they made an error. They were unable to contact the ATC. They were highly focused on their task and they didn't pay attention to the trail on. So, according to you, how can we explain auto trail on misperceptions? What is your opinion? Why pilots may not pay attention to auditory alarm?
Target focus. Fixation.
Sorry?
Target fixation.
Yeah, this is exactly what's observed. What are the other explanations?
Emotional disturbance?
Yeah, this is a code.
Mental capacity is overloaded.
The thing is, if you take a look at the stats, I mean, the big one is what we call the crying wolf effect.
Yeah.
This was, it's so cool, like maybe 20 years ago, a lot with GPWS alarm, the ground proximity warning system, or the TCAS, flight collision avoidance system, because these damn alarms were yelling all the time. Okay, and there is a famous accident, I don't remember, the last sentence of the pilot is, shut up, Ringo. Ringo is the nickname of the GPWS alarm.
Yeah.
It was yelling all the time. Unfortunately, that day, it was maybe cloudy, or there are no visibility on the landing ground, and it was not on a good approach, and then hit the mountain. But I mean, didn't trust the alarm because nearly every day he experienced a lot of erroneous, spurious auditory alarm. So this is one of the main explanations. The other one is, you see, this alarm is so aggressive, disturbing. You want to talk with your crew member, with the ATC, and you hear all these sounds in the cockpit. So the first reaction for pilot is try to clear the immediate alarm. That's not the way to do it. And as you say, there's target fascination issues. And what we learn also from neuroscience for human beings that most of the time vision is dominant over hearing. So as a human being, I'm trained to use, visual information is very important. If you want to move, if you want to avoid, it's chair and everything. So most of the time I rely on visual information. And that's what happened in the cockpit, because you need vision to monitor the flight parameters, take a look at the landing ground, at the airport and so on. And so the hypothesis is that maybe vision there's competitive process within the brain, and sometimes the vision may take over the dominant of our hearing. So to explore this hypothesis, we use EEG. So EEG is the electroencephalography. We measure electric activity on the scalp. And what we wanted to do was to reproduce what happened in this movie. So what happened in this movie is that, I mean, from the visual point of view, you could land. Because, okay, no aircraft on the landing ground. The speed was good, the vertical speed was good, so I mean it was good for landing, and only from a visual point of view. From an auditory point of view, you were supposed to perform a ground. So there was a conflict between visual and auditory information. We reproduce a very simplified landing test. So participants were supervising a landing, an automatic landing. They are supervising very simple visual information, and they also have auditory alarms. And in some cases, the visual information say no go, and the auditory alarm say no go. So you have to perform a go round, of course. And in some situation, you have a conflict between the visual information, like in the previous movie, so you may land, and the auditory information perform a go round. So when you use EEG, or electron photography, and for example, if I make this count, as soon as you hear the sound, you can measure this kind of components, which is called N100, N for negative because it goes down, and 100 because it occurs like 100 milliseconds after the onset of the sound. And if this amplitude, I mean, if this component is, the amplitude of this component is high, is very large, it means that you have correctly perceived the sound. So in red, it is when the visual information say no go and the auditory information say no go. So you can tell from that pilots have perceived the information and they are also, from a behavioral point of view, they perform a go wrong. Here, with the dash dots red curve, this is the situation when the visual information say you may land and most of the pilot perform a landing and the auditory information say go around. Okay, so there's an alarm, so you have to perform a go around. From a behavioral point of view, pilots do not pay attention to alarm because they perform the landing. And you can observe this, that the amplitude of this curve is much lower, significantly lower than that one. And what's the explanation? It means that as soon as the pilots take into account the visual information saying that you may land, then they inhibit the auditory processing. Okay, I can learn, so I don't care about other information like auditory processing or like auditory information. So you are able, you have a kind of shortcut and you are able to quickly inhibit early attention auditory process. What is interesting is 100 milliseconds, it means that it is an automatic process. There are no awareness. Awareness is around 300 milliseconds or later. Okay, so this is totally automatic process. I can tell you one of my personal story. It was like 2 or 3 years ago, I was driving on the ring road, and you know that people in Toulouse are very bad drivers. The weather was not very good, but I was very focused on a highly important information. So I'm from Bordeaux, you know, the wine country. I'm from Bordeaux, I love football, and just wanted to know whether or not my football team has won the match. So I was highly focused on listening to the information on the radio. But suddenly, there was a crash just in front of me, and I had to perform an emergency braking. Hopefully, I survived the crash, and there were no people harmed around me. But after that, I was unable to tell you whether or not my team has won the match. Okay? So, of course, that was not relevant anymore, but anyway, this is illustrate this kind of process where you are able to quickly filter out non-relevant information. So it can save your life, but it could be very dangerous in other critical situations, like in aviation. And this task was performed by one of my colleagues, Michael Kuss. And here, this is another component called P300, P for positive, 300 because it occurs 3 milliseconds after the onset of the sound. But let's say that when you see this nice curve, it means that the pilot have perceived the auditory alarm. Here, they started to miss a lot of auditory alarm. And here, it was a high load condition. They had a lot of things to do. There was a high visual load. They were processing visual information. And they were unable to correctly recognize auditory alarm. And you see that these components, there are no more P300 components, meaning that no processing of auditory information. And these kind of results are quite promising because you say maybe in the future we could place some sensors like EEG within the helmets of pilots. Maybe we can measure in real time that the auditory processing are inhibited and so on, and maybe that the pilot didn't notice the alarm. And we reproduce this situation, a more ecological situation, in our flight sim at Supéo. Sorry for that. So what was the story of the scenario? The participants were supposed to perform a landing on Toulouse Blagnac. They were supposed to perform a landing, but at a certain moment, they had a landing gear failure. So they have to deal with this situation. And the visual of the landing gear failure, you can see that there are two green and one red instead of three red. So from a visual point of view, there was visual information telling the pilot that there was a landing failure. And they had also an auditory alarm by triple shine, ding, 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 telling them that there was an issue with the landing gear failure. But exactly at the moment where they face the landing gear failure, we trigger a wind shear at this precise moment. So it's a motion flight platform simulation, and when you face a kind of wind shear, then the cabin is falling down. So very impressive, very impressive. Exactly at the same moment as they face the ultra alarm. So we expected that the pilot would be so focused on trying to recover from the stall that they will not pay attention to the ultra alarm. And this is what happened because 8 pilots out of 14 didn't perceive the alarms. Here in red, you see this is the eye tracking, this is eye movement. And you see that this pilot will perform a landing he will perform a belly landing, and you will see that he will be experiencing target fascination because he will be mostly focused on the landing round. I know why the sound is so poor. So that was the alarm giving me. So you can see my movement. You see that there is kind of target fascination toward the landing ground. He's not scanning the landing gear parameters, and then he will perform a beautiful belly landing. So just to end this presentation, we are working hard on implementing solutions. And when you pilot is experiencing target fascination, perseveration, there's a kind of paradox because how can one cure human operators when they face such situations if they don't perceive any warning? Okay, you may say you're all the warning, they won't be able to perceive them. So what can we do? And according to what did Airbus or what did Boeing or what did other aircraft manufacturer in the past when there were accident reports telling that I didn't pay attention to what is the immediate reaction of engineers. They don't perceive alarm. What's the solution?
Make it louder for me.
They don't hear the sound, so what's the solution? Oops. They increase.
Make it louder for me.
So you have to make it louder, okay? That's not the solution. People at NASA did a famous experience like 15 years ago, and there was a crew in the cockpit performing a quite difficult landing, and just a few seconds before the landing, they are yelling GPWS alarm like 10 times louder than it has to be. And the pilots were so secure, they are so frightened to death that they desperately tried to land, okay? And you see eye movements where the pilot were unable to move his eyes, was focus on the landing run and back on the landing, okay? So you may frighten people with too much loud alarm. And so people add more information in the cockpit, more visual flashing in the cockpit, but anyway, they don't pass it down. Too much information is not good, so. But if the idea is to go back to neuroscience and selective attentional process, we have different network involving in the attention process, and one is particularly interesting, it's called orienting network. This means that if I want to look at you, and then I want to change my focus for, let's say, to consider you, then I have first to disengage, to shift my focus, and then re-engage, okay? I mean, I'm engaged, meaning that if there are noise, people around, I will still be able to be focused on you, okay? And many studies that stressors and emotion may affect, impair this network. So as I told you, things I wanted first to disengage, to shift, and then to re-engage. It's very simple model of attention, of course, But there are people with brain lesion, like in the area called Pulvina, in the thalamus, and these people with such lesion in the brain area are able to shift their focus. Okay, they are highly focused on one task, one thing. And they did some experiments with monkeys, because when people have disease, there are a lot of holes in the brain, unfortunately. So they did some experiments with monkeys. Let's say with the needle, they made a hole in the pulvina, and the monkeys were unable to shift their attention. Okay. So the first object, they are highly focused on it. To show bananas, they will have trouble even to shift their focus to one banana. And interestingly enough, I don't know if you remember what I told you about in the beginning of this talk, the comparison between healthy but stressed subjects and patients with brain lesion, especially in the prefrontal cortex. And Tracy and colleagues did a nice experiment 14 years ago. They placed people in fMRI, and participants were supposed to click as soon as they see a target among a lot of visual distractors. And let's say a mighty head or anyway, kind of target, they have to push to select to push a button as soon as they detect the target. So in one condition there were no stressors and the participants were very good at doing the task. And in another condition it was there was a lot of noise, it was highly noisy, highly stressing noise in the fMRI. And participants were unable to shift their attention to detect the target. And interestingly enough, this part of the brain, the pulvina, was inhibited. Okay, so in one case you have a hole in the brain, in this part, and people are not able to change their focus. And in another situation, due to stressors, like stressing sound, may affect this part of the brain, and inhibit this part of the brain, and participants are unable to shift their attention. So this kind of consideration can help us a lot to design cognitive countermeasures in order to wake up the pilots, to give the pilots the good information. And what was the basic idea? The basic idea was to remove the information, the display, on which the pilot is excessively focused, in order to perform the disengagement, then to replace the message with in the visual field, to display the message in the visual field, in order to shift and re-engage the attention process. So the user interface shifts, disengage, re-engage the attention focus, and it acts like a cognitive prosthesis. So for 10 years we're doing such research for Airbus, but I'm not allowed to show you what we've been for Airbus. We have another project funded by French Defense. And because everybody knows UAV, unmanned vehicles, during the recent wars, we are using a lot of unmanned vehicles. And the thing is that to operate one human unmanned vehicle, we need like 10 human operators to operate one single UAV. And now we want like one human operator to operate like 10, 15, 20 UAVs. But of course, this kind of human operators will probably face attentional tuning issue, target fascination issue. So we have found to design cognitive countermeasures to help human operators to deal with excessive workload and so on. But we designed a task where we placed participants in a room here, and there was a robot, autonomous robot, evolving in the outside in the campus of Supero. And the robot was supposed to find a target thanks to infrared sensors. And as soon as the target was detected, the human operator was supposed to take over and to identify the target. Is it a friendly or foe target? That was the basic task. So, but what we did is when the participants were highly focused on identifying the target, we triggered low battery events. So that led to fail-safe mode, and the robot wanted to go back to base. So there was a conflict between the human operator who wanted still to perform the target identification task and the robot who was trying to take over to go back to base. Of course, that was the user interface. There was a poor design, of course. But the participant had a panoramic video, they had a synoptic, tactical map to supervise the position of UAVs, the manual versus autonomous, and the health of the UAV. So when the failure occurred, this target turned from red to green. There was a big message, like low battery. This indicator was flashing, flight mode annunciator was flashing two times, flashing from manual to autonomous mode. And the robot was changing from search target back to base. So there were three beyond information telling the human operator that something wrong occurred. Okay? But we expected the human operator to be so focused on the panoramic view that they won't be able to detect the alert. So according to our theories, what we did is we removed this video for 1 second in order to test the hypothesis of cognitive countermeasures and to place here to display the battery failure. Okay. So this is one participant who didn't have any cognitive countermeasures, and you see that he's experiencing target fascination. This is the eye position. He's not scanning anymore his user interface, and for 50 seconds. And here, the participant with cognitive countermeasures, and he's supposed to look here. So you'll see that, okay, just removing for 1 second. Let's see it again. Just removing for less than 1 second this panoramic video, the human operator automatically glanced at the correct information, automatically found the good information. Okay, so we can use very short, short time removal information to recover the pilot. Okay, and just to finish my talk, what we'd like to do, so you see that we have sensors like eye tracking, EEG, near infrared spectroscopy, and we have solutions to assist pilots. So the idea is to connect these tools and in order to be able to monitor the pilots, to perform an online monitoring of the pilots and to adapt the interaction. So we have this neurocockpit project, and what we can do is we can place pilots in our flight sim and we can monitor its brain activity thanks to the FNIRS, the near infrared spectroscopy. And pilots have to do some task interaction with ATC, for example, and in real time we can monitor brain activity. We've got algorithms that are able to discriminate low workload versus high workload. And then we can send a cognitive countermeasure to adapt the interaction dynamically in real time thanks to this kind of sensors. We can also use this kind of sensors. You see, this is eye tracking. This is in the real flight operation. It is in Der 400 at Lasbord aircraft. We can monitor pilot activity in real time. It's in real flight operation. And you see that the measure is quite accurate because you will glance at the speed. Speed again. We may think in the future this kind of technology will be integrated with the cockpit. And what we can do with this kind of data, so we've developed in the lab some algorithms, and one of our students is here tonight working on this kind of algorithm, and we just monitor the ballistic of the eye, I mean how the eye moves in the scene. And we can learn a lot of things from this. I'm not going to comment this, but anyway, this pilot experience excessive focus, and you can see it because the eye is not moving anymore. And analyzing the ballistic of the eye, we can detect in real time, just with a camera, filming the eye position, the eye movement, we can infer such situations. And you will see the exact opposite situation. The pilot will experience kind of conflict with automation. There's a lack of understanding, you will see high velocity saccades. Very few fixation, I mean no information processing. Okay, it's a kind of panic mode, and with kind of sensors we are able to detect this. So the idea is to manage attacking EV heart rate and sound to diagnose the community state on the pilot and to adapt interaction. So yes, that's the end of my talk. If you have any questions, please.
Thank you.
To do multitasking. And I noticed myself that in my 30s I could multitask, do three or four tasks at a time by changing them. But now I can just cope with one, I can't cope with two at a time. So when I'm writing an email, my wife talks to me, I just have to either ignore her or write the email, and write the email or speak to her. This, to me, it's a worrying factor that people carry on working until their 60s, flying commercial aircraft.
Yeah, there have been, sorry.
So that's the one question. I was fortunate that I had an excellent instructor when I was very young who taught me how to scan properly and not fixate on one instrument, and not fixate on one information, one lot of information, and to understand what it's telling me. And I kept that with me for most of my career until I started getting old.
Yeah, but it's not that much the issue. I mean, we did some study in the lab, my colleague Michael Coles, and there's been a lot of studies in the United States in the last decade, because there was this change from 60, I think it was the 60 rules, it changed to 65 rules. I mean, yeah. After 60, as an American pilot, you were supposed to stop flying, then they change it to 65 and so on. So they conducted many studies, right? Pilots were supposed to perform a cognitive task, multitasking, doing a memory task with a mental calculation plus, a lot of tasks. And of course, when you start to be at 40, you experience cognitive decline. I'm 40, so I can tell about that. So I'm experiencing cognitive decline. But anyway, pilots were also, they did the task, and pilots were also doing some flight sims also. And what they found is that, of course, people after 40 were not that good doing the cognitive test batteries. But when they were in the aircraft, they were very good. Okay, there's no clear relationship between your performance in cognitive test batteries and your performance in the aircraft, because you have expertise and that shields you. Okay, this is very important. We did some experiments with people who are like 65 years old. I mean, they were very good flying the flight team. They are very good. They are very good pilots, but they had a very poor performance during the cognitive test batteries. So that's not predictive. It's quite dangerous. What we see now is that people like 60 years old, they learn to fly at 60. Okay, so that's not. Not very good, because you have not expertise, and we have many accidents with people starting to learn flying at 50, 60, and yeah, there will be a lot of aviation issues, probably, especially in light aircraft. But be sure that your expertise shields you against this kind of cognitive declines. And what we observe is that pilots have very good cognitive abilities. Okay, if you are a pilot, it means that you have very good attentional abilities, good working memory abilities. And then, as you start from very high, of course you decline, like everyone, like every human. But as you decline from very high, it also shields you again, this kind of cognitive decline. I don't know if I'm clear enough, if you understand the point, but you're good, you're top. I mean, people who have no education, for this kind of people, the cognitive decline is really an issue. But for pilots, engineers, we are more or less shielded against this kind of issue. So that's the good news.
I'll tell them all.
Yeah. Please.
Jean, do you not have it?
No, I didn't say that it was.
Habit.
I didn't say that it was not effective at all.
But it can be stressful instead of having a visual information.
So yeah. The thing is that you say that you become, when you're facing a stressing situation, first you're becoming deaf, then you're becoming blind. Okay. All instructors say that, and so this is not the best, probably the best design in a highly stressing situation. But the thing is that the good thing is to mix visual information and auditory information. Synchronize flashing visual information and it's not flashing auditory information, but how to say? I mean, you have to synchronize visual and auditory information.
Well, yeah.
And I know that there are recent tentative to introduce tactile information in the cockpit. You already have tactile information when you experience stall. You have thank you very much. But that's not also the perfect solution. Because there was a famous accident that occurred like 40 years ago. It was at flight test centers in the United States. I don't remember, but it was very famous, one of the most famous flight test centers in the US. And the crew was flying, were operating F-111. I don't know if you call this plane.
Well,
F-111. I mean, it's a big F, like a big F-14, like a big Tomcat. And the thing is that if you have to perform an ejection, it's not the seats that eject, it's the whole cabin that ejects, okay? So the test pilots, I mean, they had a problem. I don't remember the problem, but they started to spin, okay? And when you spin, you don't have, you know, everybody knows that you don't have to move the sides to the stick, and the student was so frightened that he started to shake the stick, and things were very bad. It turned very bad, and then the spin was terrible, and the only solution was to perform an ejection, and there was an auditory alarm in the cockpit. And it happens that the co-pilot decided to perform the ejection. So there was, so they wanted to know after the crash what happened, of course, and there was a try to know what happened and why did the captain didn't decide to perform to trigger the ejections, and the co-pilot said the pilot was unable to any kind of decision making. Okay, he was still fighting with the aircraft, trying to recover, to perform upset recovery. There was yelling alarms in the cockpit. He didn't react to them, so I didn't want to die. Then I decided to perform the ejection. And also, the co-pilot told that during the ejection, so you experience like 14, 15 Gs, I don't know, something like this, the pilot was still trying to fly the aircraft. Okay, the cabin was ejected, okay, and the pilot was still handling the aircraft. So this is what we call tactile information, big tactile, huge tactile information, but the pilot was so stressed, so facing target fascination, that he was unable to react to the situation. It's only when the parachute opened that he started to stop flying the aircraft. So this is quite difficult, and the thing is that you need well-trained pilots and very good user interface, good design, good cockpit design in order to avoid this kind of critical information. But of course, auditory information is not the best. It's not the best solution.
So any other ones? I don't know if it will.
Don't be shy, please.
Another question. Do you have any recommendations on what has to be improved in human factors?
I mean, in terms of cockpit design? Or?
Yes.
There's a lot of... maybe we have to talk about this later, but... I think the key issue is, with the, I mean, the system are so complex nowadays, and when you observe accidents, and you see that, I mean, the, it's not, I mean, sorry, you see that the complexity of modern transportation aircraft can overwhelm even the most experienced pilots when something goes wrong. I mean, the systems are so complex that pilots have to deal with a high temporal pressure, with a very complex situation. It's very hard for pilots to understand the behavior of the aircraft, the behavior of the system. So I think the system maybe are too complex, we've been too far for automation, and maybe we have, it's not, I mean, Jean Pinet already said for decades that you have to integrate, of course, human design of automation to improve the interaction between pilots and automation, and also to maybe simplify the cockpit, because there are too much information in the cockpit. Everybody knows the accident with the A380 that occurs like two with the Qantas air flight. You know, I mean, the aircraft talk too much. I mean, Boeing, Airbus, and every, because it's important to have information. But what the pilot, I think, needs is what are my resources? What I can still do? What can I do? What are my resources? Is it still possible to them? I don't care about the failure of the subsystem anywhere and the subsystem. What can I do? I think this is the key issue, is maybe to have not so much talkative aircraft. And this is what we show with the cognitive countermeasures. When you simplify the cockpit, automatically the brain adapts to it. Yeah?
You have an experiment on removing visual information to persuade the pilot to look at a warning. Two questions on that. Is that a stress-causing situation which could lead to total confusion with somebody who is focused? And secondly, is there an alternative method of enforcing concentration on the alarms by, for example, superimposing a larger image of the relevant instrument or light on the visual?
That's a highly relevant question. And when we do these experiments with the information removal, visual information removal, we also measure heart rate, okay? Because heart rate is related to stress. And what we find that the group who didn't have any cognitive countermeasure had a higher heart rate than the one who had information removal, okay? So it does seem to relax, in fact, people. And interestingly enough, we did some experiments for Airbus or other experiments in the past. Many pilots didn't remember that they had the information removal. That was so fast, so quick, they say, okay, no, I noticed the alarm. But when you then you show the movie to the participant, you say, oh, no, you remove information in the cockpit. So that this didn't seem to be so stressing. But we have to do more experiments, of course. And one of my colleague Michael Coles is experimenting new solutions. I don't know if you have heard about what we call mirror neurons. Mirror neurons is a property of the brain. This is probably how babies learn how to move, how to react in the environment. So you have the motor cortex. This is the processing of the motor activity. And if I, for example, if I'm flying an aircraft, I will of course activate the motor cortex. But if I see a video with a pilot and flying the aircraft, my brain will also activate in the same way. Okay, if I do the action, I've got an activation of the brain. If I look, for example, you pulling the stick, I will activate also my brain in the same way, but with not with the same level, with the same amplitude, with the same strength, with the same force. But anyway, I've got the same activation. So my colleagues started to do some experiments in the flight sim where you see kind of avatar, the 3D characters, a hand doing pulling the stick, because there is a pull-up situation, there's an imminent collision with the terrain. And so you compare the reaction time of the pilot when they had the auditory alarm, like pull up, and their reaction to the kind of 3D scenes with the hand pulling them the stick, and he had 10-15 times lower reaction time. Pilots were very good to replicate the action of the 3D characters or the avatars. So because you see it activates your, I mean, it's kind of shortcut, it activates your brain and your brain motor cortex, and you're very fast to do the task. So maybe it could be an alternative solution to information removal to show some actions to the pilots in order to have faster reaction time and better reaction, especially in highly critical situations like loss of control and so on. But we have to investigate this kind of situation, of course, it's quite difficult.
What do you think about removing the cockpit window? I mean, that will remove a lot of information. There is already, I've read a bit about this, that they're starting to look into these kind of designs.
Yeah, just because it reminds me something that when we did the experiment, with the belly landing with in our flight scene with the wind shear, okay, and most of the pilots performed belly landing. So what we did, we had a head-up display in the cockpit, and what we did is we only superimposed the three dots, the two green and one red, okay? That meaning that there's a landing affair, so there was three big dots in the head-up display, just in front of the visual field. And we tested this solution, and when we were observed with some of pilots, they were so willing to land. They were trying to move their head to see through the dots and to land. And there was an accident that occurred in Pakistan. I don't remember what kind of aircraft, but there was the pull-up that was superimposed on the PFD. So they have the pull-up message. And the French safety board, the safety board say they were probably looking at the PFD at this moment because they were talking about speed and altitude. But they keep talking, and they have the pull-up superimposed on the PFD, and probably they were trying to avoid this information. It's like the monkey. I don't know if you remember the game with the monkey. Okay, if you don't want to see the monkey, you won't see it. So this is why you need to remove information first in order to disengage, and then to superimpose correct information. That's what we can learn. So sorry, and if I answer your questions, maybe it could be a solution to have pure dark cockpit, because when you see the landing ground, you may have some target fascination, and maybe with this kind of display, you can remove information or simplify the outside world, and maybe it will help the cognitive process. So maybe it's a solution, but of course, you have to do some experiments to be sure.
Save a lot of weight.
Yeah.
In the short term, is training more training?
Yeah, training is the solution, but when you look at recent accident reports, you may have highly experienced pilots, and they did wrong. They have a lot of experiences, but the situation is so complex, and maybe they have too much operational pressure, too much fatigue, and you may be the best pilot ever. You can still face target fascination or perseveration. But of course, training is the key issue, I think. Mm. But it's all about training, cockpit design. This is and procedure. I think if you want to improve safety, you have to change procedure, or to have the best procedure, you have to have the best training and the best design. You need these three things to have good safety.
I think that's all we'll say. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for
we have a
patience.
A little present.
Oh,
for you.
Thank you very much.
That has a
where's the beer? No, thank you very much.
The other thing, just we have our program. If you could put this back in again, and just we could talk about what our program is for the next few lectures, which is coming together. Our next lecture, in fact, is due to be on the 21st of October, and it was going to be in his symposium room, but that's occupied again, and we're looking to have it in the Marien Blagnac. Does that sound a sensible place to have a lecture? In downtown Blagnac. The Marie has a lecture hall there. Is that working now? How can I get this to work?
Doesn't appearing, I think. 10.
it, but it's just showing the task screen.
Not very good with PC.
It was actually showing the Windows. Anyhow, just to say that we have David Owens talking about training crews for resilience and trying to help them deal with situations that they're not expecting, perhaps going back to Jean Pinet saying this is trying to see what Airbus is doing. And then the next lecture, I don't know if anybody, if you heard of, do you know Cliff Spink, Claudius? He's actually a retired air marshal from the Royal Air Force, but he's still flying vintage aircraft. He flies Spitfires and ME-109s. And Cliff Spink's going to come and talk to us in November. And in December, we've just got agreement for Inmarsat. You know the Malaysian aircraft, which had disappeared. But Inmarsat, the satellite company, managed to get signals from it where they could actually establish that it was going out over the Indian Ocean. And they're going to give us a presentation on how they worked that out. I think it'd be nice if it's planned by then. That takes us to December, and in January, we have our annual Gordon Corr lecture. And this year, Andrew Warner. Do you know Andrew Warner, who's the chief test pilot of now Airbus helicopters? He's going to talk to us about safety, especially in helicopters. And going on later in the year, we have the Rolls-Royce mini lecture competition. And then what we have in April is somebody from the Flight Simulation Group of the Royal Aeronautical Society, David Allerton, who is a mathematician, basically, and he's going to explain how GPS works and how your... It says GPS without the mathematics. And David has a PhD in maths from Trinity Cambridge University, but he will take the mathematics and explain it to us in very simple terms on how GPS work and how you can find your way using your phone. Anyway, I hope that gives you an idea of the lectures we're coming up. As I say, the next one's David Owens. Then we have Cliff Spink talking about flying Spitfires. You might be interested in that, Claudius?
Of course.
And as I say, and then in December we have Inmarsat explaining how they managed to trace the Malaysian aircraft for a limited period. Anyway, thank you very much indeed. I don't know how this... Can't get that to work anyhow. Well, thank you very much indeed, Frederick. And thank you very much, Paul, for coming. Windows 8, which is difficult. We can stop the window
here. And I'll try to... Sorry about that.
That's my first conference.
Hello?
Turu, my name is.
Your name is what?
Turu.
Hello, Turu.
That's my first conference, so I don't know if you are taking attendance list.
Well, we have that there, in fact. Well, I saw it. Have you got your name down there?
Sorry?
Is your name down there? Or
Should be
mine
this.
Is here.
Yes.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, should we check it?
What?
You're soon.
Yes, indeed. But actually enough, my hobby horse is... I'll write it down, because it's interesting that I'm talking about things going fashion. Now it's go-around to fashion.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Fashion... But then you've got to look further back and say, well, why was the approach unstabilized in the first place? What am I?
I'm very much embarrassed by that, you know, and
We are just looking at small pieces. We have to go and much wider. But I don't know how.
There are so many, but my hobby horses, you know, have been non-precision, amongst other things, non-precision approaches. Yeah. The Americans still have a mental blockage, I think. Now, I don't know what we were taught on the approach. You fly a rate of descent based on the ground speed. Is that right? Yeah. So if you're doing 140 knots, 700 feet a minute, 200 knots, 1,000 feet a minute. Yeah. Americans don't seem to have that in their brains at all.
Bye bye, see you next time.
I think I told you, you know, Kathy Abbott said, oh no, they can't use vertical speed, they don't understand it.
We have to.
Kathy Abbott, je sors la 12-7.
You mentioned that 15 years ago there was a breakthrough on this. There was more for one person, and now you kind of you want to you, people in the research they introduce the group dynamics. So the edge right now the research is the group dynamics.
The leader is how to say this afternoon, the blend part.
You mentioned the crash. I think there was a Pakistan airline crash. Well, there was an Airbus that crashed. Yeah. The pilot was arresting the co-pilot, and the co-pilot didn't want to speak up.
Yeah, exactly.
They want to challenge.
Yeah, this kind of pilot.
If you challenge, you mentioned, I think, the case you mentioned.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in knowing more details, there's a guy in Airbus who investigated this crash. He went out to Pakistan. He told me the story firsthand. I don't know if you have this contact with.
No, I don't have this contact. I could make contact with
that guy as well. If you,
if I can get some information, but I need to know.
And he explained me actually what I understand, that in aerospace usually there's a culture of sharing mistakes and sharing problems.
Yeah.
Maybe Airbus doesn't want to be, you know, seen in public blaming Pakistan in management style, because that could harm, you know, the reputation of
I brought it.
Yeah.
Voila. You got your specs on? Yes, you do. You have it all the time.
No, they're not. They're my longest.
Oh, right. Well, here you are. I mean, there's Airbus, as you know. And this is AD Sud, which is a huge complex, of course. This is the.
That's the
Petit Tiet Expert.
Ah, Petit Tiet.
Petit Tiet Expert. That's what we were thinking about. But that's what. That, in fact, the Marie is there.
Yes. Yes.
So,
And there's a guy called.
Yes, in fact, it's not far from the restaurant.
Yeah.
It's, in fact, it's just up from the restaurant.
Yeah,
that's where the restaurant is, down there. Just there. Sorry, that's where I park. The restaurant is on that curve there, just there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so there's plenty of parking down here.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Golly, that's simple, isn't it? And where would the place be, did you say? Here?
The Marie.
No, that's where the Marie is, but where they are offering.
Oh, that's it.
In the Marie itself.
In the Marie itself.
Ah.
Yes, I'm scared there tomorrow morning. Anyhow.